Welcome to the Healthy Skin Show with Jennifer Fugo, where we're flipping everything you've been told about your chronic skin issues upside down and connecting you with alternative solutions your dermatologist never told you about.
Welcome back to episode number 295 of the Healthy Skin Show. This is part two of the dairy versus plant-based milk conversation I started last week. So if you missed that conversation, I'd recommend that you check it out first. It's important to know what someone's beliefs and biases are before diving into information like this, especially when emotions tend to run high. This episode will focus more on the specifics of each type of dairy option. This includes the nutritional content and a lengthy list of criteria that I came up with to provide a more holistic view. And depending on what factors are more important to you, this hopefully will offer insight into each dairy and plant-based milk option that you really care about. Because what's important to me personally may be very different for you, especially if your health goals and current challenges, as well as ethics, are different from my own. And before we go any further, I have to give a major shout out to my associate clinical nutritionist, Michelle Nealon, who's been on the show before, for doing a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of the research on this topic. So to kick things off, let's start by exploring the nutritional profiles of different dairy options. This isn't the most glamorous of information, but I do think that it helps to provide perspective. This nutritional content is based on every single dairy option being the same 8-ounce serving size. And since I focus heavily on protein intake, this is a great place to begin. Cow and goat milk provide 7 to 9 grams of protein per serving, with soy milk coming in close, around 7 to 8 grams. Unless fortified with extra protein, all of the other dairy-free milk products generally contain 0 to 3 grams per serving. And if we factor in the carbohydrate content, things get a little bit tricky for plant-based milk because many are sweetened with added sugars. So keep in mind that what we're sharing here is only unsweetened varieties that we reviewed. Cow and goat milk typically contains 10 to 12 grams of carbs, while the carb count varies significantly with plant-based options, starting at about 26 grams for rice milk, dropping then to 14 grams for oat milk, then down to 4 grams for soy milk, and the lowest carb contents came in typically around 1 to 2 grams for hemp, almond, cashew, hazelnut, and coconut. Now, that content tends to vary as well, with whole cow and goat milk being around 8 grams and the low-fat varieties being around 2.5 grams. Most other dairy-free milk is generally between 2 to 5 grams. Now, I do think it's worth noting that nut, including almonds and oat milk, are high in omega-6 fats, which generally are considered to be more inflammatory when consumed in excess. The only plant-based milk with omega-3 fats is actually hemp milk. Then when we look at calorie content, this also varies quite a bit. And though I don't often worry about calories in my practice, I thought it might be worthwhile to include this information should someone want to know this. Whole cow and goat milk is usually around 150 calories, while low-fat varieties are around 110 calories. And again, assuming that the plant-based milk is unsweetened, because obviously this will impact total calories, the total calories range from the low end of like 25 to 35 calories for almond, cashew, and hazelnut, to stepping up to 50 to 60 calories for hemp and coconut milk, whereas soy and oat milk generally are around 90 calories, while rice comes in at 130 calories because of the high carb content. Before you're like, Jen, my head is swimming, I feel like the facts and numbers and everything just like flew out of my head and I don't even know what is what, don't worry. We created a really easy to use chart for you that is over in the show notes, because I personally would find it difficult just listening to somebody rattle all this off, and I figured a chart would make it super easy for you. So when we look at the micronutrients of different milk profiles, this is where plant-based milks really falter. there is just no way for plant-based milk to match animal dairy unless they are fortified. So from the perspective of choosing an option that's least processed with the fewest added ingredients, dairy would win out. Cow's milk contains naturally occurring calcium, folate, iron, magnesium, phosphorus, potassium, B2 and B12, along with vitamins A and D that are usually added during processing. I should note that it also contains the highest amounts of phosphorus, potassium, and vitamin D out of all of the dairy and plant-based dairy options. However, cow's dairy lacks vitamin E. Now, soy milk naturally contains folate, iron, magnesium, phosphorus, and potassium with added, aka fortified, calcium and vitamins A, B2, B12, and D. It actually contains the highest amount of folate out of all of the milk options we reviewed, and it also lacks vitamin E. Almond milk naturally contains iron, magnesium, and potassium, but in fairly minimal amounts. Calcium and vitamins A, D, and E are generally added, and it lacks folate, phosphorus, B2, and B12. Oat milk naturally contains a small amount of iron and is typically fortified with calcium, potassium, and vitamins A, B2, B12, and D, and it lacks folate, magnesium, phosphorus, and vitamin E. Coconut milk also naturally contains a minimal amount of iron along with calcium, potassium, and vitamins A, B12, D, and E, which are all added during processing. It lacks folate, magnesium, phosphorus, and B2. Rice milk naturally contains iron and phosphorus with calcium, potassium, and vitamins A, B12, and D added to it during fortification. And generally, rice milk lacks folate, magnesium, vitamin B2, and vitamin E. Now, lastly, hemp milk contains iron with calcium, magnesium, potassium, and vitamin D. Out of all of the milks, it is the highest in the amount of magnesium and iron that it contains, but it does lack folate, phosphorus, and vitamins A, B2, B12, and E. And it's worth noting that the vitamin B12 that is added to plant-based milks during that fortification process is always the cyanocobalamin form of the nutrient, which also happens to be the cheapest form. It is not a naturally occurring form of B12. Another concern I briefly mentioned in part one of this series is the added ingredients found in many commercial plant-based milks. These ingredients are not added to homemade versions since a long shelf life isn't necessary, and you can easily flavor a homemade nut or seed milk with spices, dates, or other non-nutritive sweeteners like stevia or monk fruit. I don't want to go too deep here because I feel like while you should be aware of added ingredients, fixating on them as if they're poison is not helpful. That said, sweetened dairy-free milk generally has quite a lot of added sugar. To give plant-based milk a mouthfeel similar to dairy and prevent the ingredients from separating, which happens with homemade plant-based milks, only requiring a quick shake of the container to reintegrate, thickening agents and emulsifiers are added. These can include gums such as guar, gelin, locust, also known as carob bean, or acacia or Arabic, which aren't all that concerning in the grand scheme of things, though some people may experience some GI upset from them, but this is not in every single case. Then there's xanthan gum, which some research demonstrates that it has the potential to shift the microbiome. Then we have tapioca starch, which is another additive you might see in the ingredient list, but again, it's not something that I'd worry about. There is, however, a lot of information online about carrageenan, which is generally recognized as safe by the FDA, but there are some concerning animal studies that have shown it to be carcinogenic, associated with intestinal lesions and IBD-like intestinal changes, microbiome alterations, and inflammation. Then we have lecithins, which are often added to keep oils, also called fats, and water together, right? So it creates that emulsion of water and fat. Typically, lecithin is derived from soy or sunflower seeds. Now, because soy is such a GMO-heavy crop, if it's not marked as organic, it's likely derived from GMO soy. Now, speaking of oils, one of the biggest complaints by wellness influencers is the addition of omega-6 seed oils to plant-based milk. The common types of oils added are sunflower, rapeseed, canola, coconut, and palm, which generally increases the omega-6 fatty acid content. And then you have natural flavors, which act as a taste enhancer, but despite the name, can be up to 90% synthetic and aren't required to be disclosed what's actually in them unless there is a common allergen present. And unless you purchase some sort of flavored or sweetened dairy product or make plant-based milk from scratch, these ingredients are not included. So given the number of these added ingredients, in conjunction with nutrient fortification, this underscores why I and other nutrition professionals feel that these dairy-free products are actually processed foods. Now, when we consider heavy metal exposure, it should come as no surprise that the biggest problem is with rice milk. Specifically, rice milk is high in inorganic arsenic from the pollution of groundwater, pesticide and herbicide use, natural waste, fertilizers, and mining. Regardless of these exposures, rice is very adept at pulling arsenic from the soil, even when soil arsenic is not exceptional. To give you a sense of how high the exposure is, arsenic levels are tenfold higher in rice compared to other grains. And surprisingly, there is no limit put on the amount of arsenic found in food. But there is a limit on arsenic found in drinking water. The EPA, the EU, and the World Health Organization currently require the level in drinking water to be below 10 parts per billion. And yet, commercial rice milk products available for purchase in the UK exceed the 10 parts per billion drinking water rule. There's also been other reports over the years of both organic and non-organic rice milk in the US that also exceeds this limit. When it comes to pesticide content, all milk options are above the EPA and World Health Organization limit for organochlorine pesticides, also known as OCPs. This includes commercially produced cow, almond, coconut, soy, rice, hemp, and cashew. Glyphosate exposure is also an issue, especially impacting oat, soy, almond, and rice milk. In fact, 92% of soy crops, 89% of almond trees, and 46% of rice crops from 2012 to 2016 were sprayed with glyphosate, according to a letter in 2019 by the EPA. Both conventionally grown oats, as well as organic oats, have demonstrated levels of glyphosate beyond what the Environmental Working Group considers to be safe. It's likely no surprise that GMO soy is very high in glyphosate since it was literally engineered specifically to withstand it, whereas conventional or organic soy doesn't seem to share this concern. And we also know, and it's worth noting, that glyphosate impacts the bees negatively, which is important for the environment and not good at all for all of us to be able to produce crops and have a healthy environment and ecosystem. One factor that's often cited as a problem with the dairy industry is the vast negative impact that it has on the environment. However, I've found that even plant-based milk has its own set of issues that we need to talk about. So if we start with what impacts water use, cow's milk is the most water-hungry of them all. Almond production requires the most water of all the crops that we're looking at in this series, closely followed by rice. In fact, 17% of the, quote, agricultural water use in California, end quote, is for almond production, though it is still less than what cows require. So if we're looking at an 8-ounce glass of cow's milk versus almond milk, the cow's milk consumes approximately 50 gallons of water versus about 32.3 gallons of water for almonds. Camel milk, on the other hand, requires about half the amount of water needed by dairy cows. Hemp production is less water hungry than almond or cow's milk, but requires more than oat, soy, or pea. Soy is actually the crop that uses the least amount of water. Macadamia nuts are particularly interesting because they can self-regulate in times of drought and low soil moisture, causing the plants to use water more efficiently. In terms of the destruction of land, besides the glyphosate and pesticide use I already mentioned, conventional cow dairy production is the largest user of land and certainly does contribute to an unbelievable amount of pollution into the surrounding ecosystem via runoff. However, that's not the only option, especially in farms that participate in regenerative dairy cow practices, which actually help prevent runoff and improve the soil quality. I hope to talk more about regenerative farming practices on the show in episodes later this year, so stay tuned. There are actually two very interesting plant-based options that are supportive of the environment. So I want to talk about those. Hemp is very environmentally friendly, and it's great for helping to improve soil health and supporting biodiversity. Interestingly, it can improve land with high levels of heavy metals in the soil, and it has a naturally high level of disease resistance without the need for chemicals, and it also has low greenhouse gas emissions. Another interesting plant-based crop is macadamia nuts, which are highly sustainable and regenerative, especially given their natural ability to regulate water use. They have been shown to increase biodiversity along with the pollinators while suppressing pests, and often 100% of the crop is used, including the husk and the shell, so nothing gets wasted. One thing I would also like to highlight is packaging, since that can have an impact on the environment as well from a recycling and landfill perspective. The Tetra Paks that many of us are so accustomed to seeing, especially used in plant-based milks, are not universally recycled. Only 60% of locations in the U.S. will accept them. That said, milk cartons are generally recycled along with plastic jugs. And if you can get your milk from a local farmer in a glass container, many can be returned for reuse and a deposit return. Another point of contention regarding the environment is the carbon footprint of dairy. Conventional dairy farming produces more greenhouse gas emissions than vegetable protein farming. This is before even taking into account the deforestation for agricultural monocrops and transportation of said monocrop feed to the farms. In contrast, regenerative cattle farming practices do a better job of balancing things out because the herd is moved daily, allowing for grass to regrow while pulling carbon back down into the soil during this process. Camel milk production puts fewer emissions into the air, approximately 10 to 15% of cow ammonia emissions and 1 to 2% of methane emissions compared to cattle. Interestingly, rice production produces a sizable amount of methane when the fields are flooded. In contrast, almonds, oats, and coconuts produce lower levels of greenhouse gases. And lastly, it's worthwhile to consider where the crops you're consuming originate from. For example, cashews are grown in tropical regions, not in North America. Being aware of how far these crops have traveled just to make it to a kitchen table near you, using fossil fuels to ship them very far distances will increase their carbon footprint. I know that you've probably sat through most of this going, wow, these are some great, interesting facts. But let me promise you, the bits of this that probably are a lot more emotional are now in front of us. I didn't want to lead with this intentionally because I feel like if I had told you the following information first, it would have clouded your judgment and not allowed you to hear all of the other factual information that is just as important as this is. So as I shared in part one, one of the things that got me questioning the good for the planet slogan often associated with plant-based foods was the surprising amount of what I describe as cruel, inhumane, and abusive treatment of the workers. And it's left me asking, does the treatment of human beings involved in the process of making these products not matter? I think it most certainly does. So let's talk about several of the issues I've uncovered. Wages for workers are often low with crops produced in third world countries. Cashew production, for example, is predominantly done by female workers making less than $3 a day, while coconut farmers are paid less than $2 a day. Rice also pays low wages, about $1.20 per day, and may involve child laborers. Many of these farmers for the rice production are women, as men who legally own everything have left to go work in cities. And on top of this, the risk of physical harm is also quite real, especially when the practice of farming can be dangerous for a number of reasons. Cashew production often results in painful, caustic, permanent burns to the workers' hands, again, many of whom are women. And if you're not aware, a single cashew is grown at the bottom of a cashew apple. The nut that you're familiar with must be removed from the shell that contains urushiol oil, but workers are rarely provided protective gloves to do so. Even when gloves are available, most workers will avoid using them because of the increased difficulty shelling the nuts that ultimately slows down their efficiency and reduces their already low wages. Protective breathing gear is not provided, so the dust from shelling the cashews causes throat irritation and chest pain. Specifically in Vietnam, forced cashew production is used in lieu of a more official drug treatment program, even for children. The time a worker is required to stay can randomly be extended for up to 4 years without any explanation or warning. Abusive treatment for misbehaving, whatever that means, includes beating with wooden objects, being shocked or locked, sometimes for months at a time, in what are described as punishment rooms. While in Africa, Cambodia, and India, there is documentation showing whole families may be involved in cashew production. Workers have to deal with sexual harassment and sometimes even lose fingers due to accidents using the shell cutter blades. Now, when it comes to oat production, workers face a serious risk of being buried alive in silos and suffocating. Rice production exposes workers to standing water mixed with animal manure, associated with a high prevalence of skin diseases, with all too familiar symptoms, such as, quote, itching, burning sensation on exposed areas, pus formation, redness, pain, small wounds, burning with sweating, end quote, as well as fungal and bacterial skin infections, mosquito bites, snakes, leeches, caustic chemicals, and pesticides. And most workers end up with something called foot immersion disease, aka patty foot, where the skin of their hands and feet break out in blisters and begin to decay, along with developing infected nails that fall off. I could actually go on more in this section, but I feel like this is already a lot to take in. And needless to say that if you've ever needed a reason to do a bit more research into companies that you buy from, perhaps this is it. I'm not saying that all companies participate in or allow these types of abusive worker environments, but knowing for sure will involve asking questions of the companies, especially since their practices may not be clearly spelled out on their website. And finally, we tackle the question of the treatment of animals, since this is another point of great concern. You are likely aware of the horrendous treatment of animals involved in the factory farming method. This includes both cows and goats, and for the sake of time, I'll assume that, like me, you've already seen at least one of the documentaries about factory farming and are educated enough to know that this is not the way you'd like animals to be treated. But not all types of animal dairy farms are abusive to their livestock. Regenerative farms and local producers, both of cow and goat milk, are available, and it's important to do your research and learn what their values are. Some will even welcome you to do a farm tour so you can see how the animals are treated. And lastly, we come to animal abuse associated with coconut milk, specifically in the Thai coconut industry, where baby wild monkeys are kidnapped and sold into what are described as monkey schools, where they are trained to pick coconuts on farms. The monkeys are abused with whips and other abusive tactics until they are then sold to coconut pickers, who also provide horrific working and living conditions for these poor animals. This issue is quite recent to the release of this episode and includes coconut milk products from Thailand that are canned, boxed or packaged from a list of companies that I'll put into the show notes for you to review. Walmart appears to be the most recent chain to pull these products off of their shelves as of June 2022. Other brands, including Costco, Target, Kroger, Publix, Stop and Shop, Food Lion, Wegmans, and Albertsons have already done so. Other coconut-producing areas that include Brazil, Colombia, and Hawaii do not participate in monkey labor. So with all of this said, I hope that you're still hanging in with me here. I know it's a lot, and that's why we've created some very simplified charts with all of this information broken down for you. I know that my head would be spinning right now if I couldn't see everything in a bit more of a simplified form. So you're definitely going to want to head to the show notes to see all of these different charts. Next up in part three, I'll break down more information on the allergenicity of different dairy and plant-based options, as well as talk a bit about raw milk. Plus, I think it's important to consider accessibility because these options aren't always available everywhere, nor are they financially accessible to everyone. So if you have any questions or thoughts that you would love to share, or you want to see the charts, references, and resources that we've created, including the 34 references that are included under all of the show notes, you can go do a deep dive. You can head over to skinterrupt.com/295. That way we can keep the conversation going. And before you head off for your day, if you haven't done this yet, I would really deeply appreciate if you take a moment to review and rate The Healthy Skin Show on your podcast platform. Then make sure to hit the subscribe button. That way you can tune in each week for new research, clinical tips and strategies, personal stories, and the inspiration that you need on your journey to rebuild healthy skin. And then let's connect over on Instagram. I'm at Jennifer Fugo. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I look forward to digging deeper with you in the next episode.